And welcome to the President's Podcast of the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association, also known as the TCYLA. My name is Austin Gardner, and I'm the current president of the TCYLA. The goal of this podcast is to discuss all things legal in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. Today's topic is for the series, Huh? Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. Today, I'm joined by my guest, Christy Jack, for the topic of winning the unwinnable case. Christy Jack graduated from Baylor University cum laude with a Bachelor's of Business Administration and from Texas Tech University School of Law. She is a nationally recognized attorney who has tried more than 200 cases before a jury, including capital murder cases. Her courtroom skills and expertise in forensics and DNA have led her to appearances on 48 Hours, Dateline, Cold Case, Investigation Discovery, Forensic Files, and Court TV. Prior to becoming a criminal defense attorney, Christy Jack was a prosecutor at the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office for more than two decades. She worked through the ranks of the Misdemeanor Section, Felony Trial Division, and Crimes Against Children Unit before becoming a chief prosecutor for 15 years. She finished her time at the prosecutor's office as a deputy chief and one of only two litigation experts. Recognized by former Governor Rick Perry for her expertise in sexual assault cases, Christy Jack was appointed in 2011 to head the governing board of Texas Civil Commitment Office, where she oversees the state's most violent sex offenders. In 2014, she was tapped by Governor Perry to head the board and was sworn in as the new chair. Governor Greg Abbott reappointed her to this position, which she holds today. She's a partner at Varkey Somerset here in Fort Worth, Texas, and is also an executive board member of the Tarrant County Bar Association. Christy Jack, thank you for joining our podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I tell you what, talking to young lawyers is one of my very favorite things to do. When I was a prosecutor, I used to teach young lawyers all across the state, and we did it twice a year. And it really was one of my favorite times of the year. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's not every day that I get to talk to a an attorney that has an IMDb page. So the honor is really mine. So there was a rumor, and this question may catch you a little off guard, but I like to keep a little things in, underneath my sleeve every once in a while, that as a prosecutor, you had a bounty on your head for a hit. Is that true?
Well, unfortunately, when I was pregnant with my first child, I have two children, two boys, and I felt like I was about 12 months pregnant, but in fact was about 7 months pregnant. So very clearly, very obviously pregnant. And I was getting ready for a death penalty case. And of all the types of cases that a prosecutor prepares for, those cases in which the state seeks the death penalty are the most demanding. They're the most time consuming. And we were getting ready to try the first of two co-defendants of a capital murder. And the case was scheduled to begin when I returned from my maternity leave. And in the midst of preparing for the case, it was discovered through our narcotics unit. The narcotics unit at the time was a separate unit in the DA's office, but they had run across basically dope notes. And, you know, everything's digital now. Everything's on a phone, everything. Nothing's in writing, basically. But back then, so this would have been, let's see, my son's 20 years old, so 20 years ago. So this was before phones. This was before computers, really, for the most part. And dope notes are the scratch notes of dope dealers, you know, how much they've sold, how much money, who owes them money, that type of thing. And in the middle of the dope notes was my name and an amount of money. And of course, I had no idea. The first assistant at the time, who was Alan Levy, a greatly revered trial attorney, called me into his office to tell me what they had found, and that he was worried for my safety, as was my husband, who's also a civil attorney, and he was worried about my safety. I wanted to remain on the case, but they suggested that I find someone else to replace me. So yes, I did have a bounty on my head, and they discovered that the person that was basically trying to put out a hit was the girlfriend of one of the defendants I was about to try. And at the time, because it never really amounted to someone contracting with a would-be hitman, one of the DA investigators visited her and explained that rather than taking out a hit, she perhaps ought to become my new bodyguard, because if anything were to happen to me, she was going to be the number one suspect. So,
yeah, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
That's right. That's right. And so I'm fine. And we never heard another peep out of her.
Was the big bounty, was it a number that you think was adequate for a famous prosecutor?
I don't know that famous or infamous is the right word, but I remember being a little bit surprised. I kind of thought as a public servant, I would have been worth a little bit more than that. But it was a relatively low amount, you know, maybe it was like a Costco kind of deal. I don't know. But
Well, that's pretty funny. So you've had a ton of jury trials, as I kind of went through with the with your little bio. Not little. I mean, it's a very hearty bio.
When that just means I'm old. That's just
no,
a nice way of saying
that's qualified.
I'm old. And that's
very
okay.
Qualified. When you had your first jury trial, what do you remember about that the most?
Oh, you don't even want to know. So I started trying cases in 1991. I graduated from law school in 1991, and I was a pre-bar hire, which means the DA's office hired us, and there were a group of four of us when we joined the office before we received our bar results. So we basically had a third-year bar card, and we were able to sit in on trials and take an active role so long as we had a supervising attorney with us. I don't really consider those trials to be my first trials, because I had really minor involvements and minor roles in those cases. I consider my first trial really to be the first case that I was responsible for, and I was the lead. And that would have been shortly after receiving my bar card, because one of the great things about the DA's office is you are thrown into the thick of things immediately. And I think, as a matter of fact, the very same week that I was licensed, the same week I probably tried this case. But what I remember is that it was a DWI. And of course, that's the bread and butter of misdemeanor attorneys at the DA's office.
Right.
They're DWIs. You try them in your sleep. You could try them in your sleep, basically. And they're all very, very similar. At least at that time, they were. And at that time, this case, and again, we're talking now back in 1991, so 30 plus years ago, when somebody had a breath test, when someone gave a sample of their breath, there was a little piece of paper that was spit out by the computer that had the result. Okay. And I'm just going to tell you, I'm notorious for losing things. And so, in fact, it has been a longstanding rule at my office that don't give Christy an original of anything, because she'll lose it. She didn't mean to. There's nothing, but it will disappear. So I give everyone fair warning not to give me an original. Well, in any event, it was my first trial. I was trying it with a more senior attorney, and I was too embarrassed to say I lost the file. I lost the file. Like, I couldn't even find the file. And at that time, we had paper copies of everything. Okay. Not like it's all online. There wasn't even online at the time. But among the file, which you can get other copies of the offense reports, was the breath test. So the main piece of evidence in that case, I literally had misplaced, as in addition to the file. And so I was too embarrassed to tell anybody. So we got copies of the offense report, and I'm not even sure what I thought I was going to do when it got to that part of the trial, because it was it was a result that showed the individual, I believe, was a 0.16. And at the time, 0.1 was the level of intoxication. So it was well above that.
Yeah. Today it's 0.08.
Oh, wait, that's right. Now it's 0.08. So it was two times at that time, or it would be two times by today's standards. But in any event, so we got to that time. And at the time, the expert that testifies about DWI's name was Max Courtney. He's deceased now, but a long time forensic expert. And when he got to the stand, I said, Max, I hate to tell you this. I've lost the entire file, which is not that big a deal. We can get the offense, but I don't have the breath test slip. And he goes, Christy, I wish you had called me. It always makes duplicates. I have a duplicate right here. And so it was. And so he rescued me. No, only Max and I were the only two that ever knew about it. But it illustrated a really good point, and that is don't ever be afraid to ask a dumb question. You know, it's much better to ask the question, because I probably lost 5 pounds over the span of 2 days. I worry, like, what was I going to do? What was I going to do? How could I have been so reckless as to lose the file on my very first trial? But nevertheless, and that's one of the things that I tell young lawyers now, is there is no such thing as the dumb question, except the one you don't answer. And when I used to supervise attorneys, we actually had a thing called Amnesty Day. And it was typically at the end of the year. And it was where they could come in and tell me, we'd have dinner at the end of the year. And it was where they could tell me mistakes they had made during the year. And if it was something that I could fix, something, you know, a judgment that needed to be fixed, maybe they gave an offer that was too low that they shouldn't have, they didn't run it by me first. And then they waited every day and checked the newspaper to make sure this person didn't go out and do something really bad, which was a true story. But the one thing I did tell them was, you know, if you've made a mistake and you don't tell me and I could have fixed it, that's when you get in trouble. If you've made a mistake and you own up to it and I can fix it, all is fine. And there'll be no repercussions. So I always wanted my court teams to come and level with me and tell me about mistakes they made or ask dumb questions to avoid the mistakes that I made as a young attorney.
Yeah. You're essentially, that's funny, the Amnesty Day, it almost kind of reminds me of like a Yom Kippur or like airing of the grievances, you know, just like a kind of a cleansing day. So that's kind of funny.
And what was really funny is what happened, and I'm not going to mention any names, but my court teams, they loved this day. It became they would look forward to this day, and they would reluctantly tell on themselves, but they love to tell on each other. And one of them even made a PowerPoint about the other one and about the case that someone pled to a deferred type of probation. They didn't understand what a repeat offender notice was. And when the judge said, are you waiving the repeat offender notice, which a repeat offender notice can change the minimum, but can also change the maximum sentence someone can receive. So if you're placed on a deferred type of probation, if they violate the probation, it changes the potential punishment. It increases it. Well, the young female prosecutor didn't even know what a repeat offender notice was, which I blame myself. I was her chief. I had not sat down to explain that to her. But nevertheless, so when the judge said, are you waiving that? She didn't want to appear as though she didn't know what he was talking about and said, well, yes, we are. And then, because she didn't even realize he had a record. Okay. And then he came out and she saw how dangerous he looked and she really began to worry. Oh my gosh, I've just put this person who has a felony record on probation, and how long is it going to be? Hope to God he doesn't do something that winds up on the front page of the paper. And so she would check every day to see, okay, is this going to be the day? Is this going to be the day? And ultimately, he did violate his probation, but it was not in any major public way. She revoked his probation. No one was the wiser until Amnesty Day, when her colleague made the PowerPoint presentation.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And leave it up to you, your closest friends, to give a good slam and never miss a good opportunity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So as many jury trials have you had, do you still get nervous during jury trials?
I always get nervous. And I feel like it's kind of like when you have a playoff football game, you know, you get out there and you see these two teams and there's nerves on both sides until everybody kind of calms down. And it's like that with a jury trial. No matter what, the jury panel that's in front of you is a different group of people that you've never been in front of. It's a different case. Every single case that I've ever tried, there's no two cases alike, really. And so I always get nervous. And then as I'm standing up talking, and oftentimes I'll tell a panel, no matter how many years I've been doing this, no matter how many juries I select, there's still a bit of nerves when I stand up. But at some point during jury selection, the nerves go away and I don't even realize when they go away.
Yeah. Why did you want to get into criminal law?
Well, that's an interesting question. My parents had
Thank you. I agree. That's why I asked it.
It's a brilliant question. Well, so my father was in the military. He was a Green Beret. My mother was a nurse. And then they had a rental property business. So they actually wanted me to be a real estate lawyer. And I did not have any interest in that whatsoever. But the other component to that was my uncle, who I'm very close to, was a homicide detective with the Arlington Police Department. And I loved hearing stories about how he was solving cases or not solving cases. And his work, I loved hearing about it. And so it was just something that was very natural to me. And so it was probably in that first semester of law school that I realized, you know, I love criminal law. I love reading these cases. And I've just never stopped loving this area of the law.
Yeah. And I kind of had the same thing. I was more interested in family law, and here I am doing CPS cases and family law cases. And I even try to buck my, propensity to go towards family and say, I'm going to go take some different classes, explore some interests. And I took gift and estate tax law. And that was like watching paint dry to me. I couldn't get out of that case or that class quick enough. Oh my goodness. And I took it pass fail. Only exam I walked out of, even taking it pass fail, that I thought, well, I failed. I'm going to have to take that one again.
Well,
but
it's
I passed all as well.
Well, great. It's interesting though, because my husband, as I said, is a corporate and bankruptcy attorney at Haynes and Boone. And I remember calling him one time. Well, I used to say he makes all the money so I can have all the fun. But I remember one time I had finished trying a capital murder case, not a death penalty case, when we'd waived the death penalty. And part of the evidence was the fact that, and I was a prosecutor at the time, the fact that the defendant had admitted to his closest friend, they'll never tie me to that shit. Okay. And so it was like an admission that they'll never catch me. Okay. And so that was a big piece of evidence. And on appeal, the large part of the appeal had to do with the legal and factual sufficiency of someone's guilt, of individual's guilt. And so when the Court of Appeals issued their opinion and I was reading it, they put great weight on this statement that he made to his best friend. They'll never tie me to that shit. So I call my husband, you know, big civil partner at a law firm. And I say, well, your opinions are never going to say this. And I'm laughing. And he goes, no, mine will say your assets are worse shit.
How funny.
Yeah. So I use that as a great example, a great illustration of the different types of law that we practice.
Exactly. What advice would you give to law students or young lawyers who are looking to either go into criminal law as a first area of law to practice, or maybe even transfer their current area?
Well, I consider criminal law much like a selfish mistress. You know, it is all encompassing, you know, to really do it right, because there's so many different disciplines that are involved in criminal law. I mean, you have so many different areas of science, DNA, YSTR, ballistics, all of the whole new area of digital forensics. You know, I had the Secret Service testify in a case a couple of years ago, and all the things they can tell about your phones. And so it is an ever-growing, and that's probably true of every area of law. I just can't speak to other areas of law the way I can speak to criminal law. But it is an area and a body of knowledge that is ever-growing, which I think is so fascinating about criminal law. I wouldn't, if I had it to do over again, wouldn't change a thing. You know, I do tell people, it was wonderful to be a public servant. It was a fantastic job. I wouldn't trade those years for anything. But you don't become a public servant to make money. And so you have to decide, are you doing it for the money? Are you doing it because it's what you love? And some people are doing it for both. But I would suggest, and I would recommend to anybody, when they're determining or deciding which area of law, do it because it's what you love. Do it because it's your passion. Don't do it just because it pays the bills.
Right. Do you have a standard way you prepare for cases for trial? And do you think you prepare cases differently as when you were a prosecutor compared to now as a criminal defense attorney?
Well, you know, as a prosecutor, We had the burden of proof. In other words, the responsibility of bringing the evidence, bringing the proof was at our table, and it was on my shoulders. As a defense attorney, my job is simply to poke holes in their evidence. And I think all the years that I was a prosecutor have really armed me with the ability to know what good detectives can do, what good crime scene officers can find, what there should be in a case. And so, you know, it took me a couple of years, I think, for the light to switch, or for the switch to turn on, to view things as a defense attorney as opposed to a prosecutor. But now it's kind of like a coach that has coached for more than one team. You know what to expect from that team or what they should be doing, and you know how to defeat that, or hopefully defeat that, or at least combat that. What I've often told young lawyers, and I believe this, you know, we can't change the intellectual gifts that God gives us. You know, we'd love to think we're the smartest attorney in the room. I rarely am, but, and we can't control that. You know, that's an immutable quality, immutable gift that God gave us. But what you can control is how prepared you are. And that's not to say that things come easy. I pour hours and hours and hours into every single solitary hour that I'm in the courtroom. And so I'm going to know that case, hopefully, better than anyone else in the courtroom. I'm not saying I'm going to be the smartest, but I'm what I can control is being the most prepared. And that's what I strive to do. Now, it's funny because my law partner, Letty Martinez, and I have a different approach to cases. I have a much more big picture approach. And if I see something in writing anywhere in a case file, it's there. And I remember it because I'm visual. And so if I say, Letty, this is in this case, I may not remember exactly where it is, but I know this witness said this. Letty doesn't have any doubt that it's there. We just have to find it. Whereas Letty is an auditory learner, and she's much more detail oriented. So we really have a very unique approach to cases, and we always try our cases together. Well, 99% of the time we try our cases together.
That's funny. I think I'm a mix between both of you. I'm an auditory learner, but a big picture person. So
yeah. Well, and it works out great because I can be like, okay, here's our overarching theme in this trial. Here's our overarching defense. And meanwhile, Letty's looking up where someone's phone checked into, or where it logged into the internet to show where that individual was, which I wouldn't have the first clue how to figure out. But it, so it makes for a very good, I think, a very good approach to criminal trials.
So, right. And work beats talent when talent doesn't work. So
there you go. There you go. And, you know, I think it's also important because, you know, you see on TV, and I think sometimes shows that involve the practice of law or trying cases, they try to portray being a trial lawyer as something that you either have or you don't have, that it just comes to you like this epiphany in the middle of the courtroom. I don't think anything could be further from the truth. You know, good lawyers are prepared lawyers, and prepared lawyers make it look easy. Not because it is.
And don't even get me started on TV lawyers. I think every lawyer has ever seen any kind of courtroom drama or movie. It's just rolling our eyes at every gavel bang because it just never happens.
Right.
I don't know. I've never seen a gavel bang unless it's an adoption final decree and the kid gets to do it, but that's about it. So, so if you'll indulge me on the next question, it's kind of a little touchy-feely. As a prosecutor, did you ever feel empathy for the defendants that had either made horrible mistakes or committed crimes when you're prosecuting those? And a follow-up to that is, has being a criminal defense attorney either changed or enhanced that at all?
Well, the simple answer to your question is yes. I often feel empathy. I think that certainly the lower level crimes as a prosecutor, it's easier to be empathetic towards those. You know, if somebody drives while they're intoxicated, most people have in their lifetime, if they're honest, they just don't get caught. So it's very easy to understand how someone could find themselves in that situation. Unfortunately, with some people, even a DWI can just change the trajectory of their life. And then the more serious the case goes, as a prosecutor, you know, the more intentional a case is, the more decisions that it took for that individual to be in that position, perhaps the less empathy you may feel towards that individual, but the more you feel towards their family, you know. And what I see as a defense attorney that I did not have access to is I see the toll that it takes on an individual that's charged with a crime. Okay. That there really is a value to and a punishment in and of itself for regret, for remorse, for bad decisions, and watching how that plays out and affects their families. And so as a prosecutor, you would never see that. You see one moment in time. It's kind of a cliche that as a prosecutor, you know, you're prosecuting one day, and then in the punishment phase, it's where a jury can see perhaps the entire photo album of a case or a photo album of someone's life. But so yes, there were instances. Now, when you get up to much, much, much more serious cases, I think the balance shifts, and all as a prosecutor you see is the toll it took on the victim's family or on the victim. You know, and sure. Even I remember a case I tried where the parents, the son had been addicted to drugs. The parents were wonderful, wonderful people. And if I had still been trying drug cases as a prosecutor, he could have been somebody that I would have prosecuted. And as a result, he found himself at a hotel and was in the midst of buying drugs and was killed. And for the parents, it was a heartbreak, but it was a heartbreak that was unique to them because they wondered, would my child have ever turned his life around? And they didn't get to see that. Right. And so there's lots of empathy that you see towards a lot of different people that are affected by these cases on both sides.
Right. You know, one of the things I kind of believe in, and some people may not believe it, and that's fine, but everyone's doing the best they can with the resources that they have. Right. And I think that, you know, it's sad. Some people get caught up in bad things, and not to excuse what they did or minimize it, but no one just makes this decision to be a drug addict overnight, right? These things don't happen in a vacuum. So
absolutely.
And I think that phrase kind of really just gives me forgiveness for things that people do.
Well, and that's why for all of the penal code, there's a range of punishment. Right. And we're one of the last states in the country that allows or entitles or enables juries to set punishment. And I think it's an amazing thing because our community gets to speak to what the crime is worth. And there's a range for a reason, because you have someone that steals something. Well, okay, you have two individuals that steal. One steals because his family's hungry and they have no money. Dad's lost his job. That's one reason, okay? Whereas you have someone else that just stole for the sport of it. It may be the exact same crime, but under far, far different circumstances.
Right. So on the case we're here to discuss today, the quote-unquote unwinnable case, if you could just kind of give a brief synopsis on the facts of this case and
sure.
How it ended up in your caseload.
Okay. Well, I joined Varghese Somerset in September of 2015, and I was told by our managing partner, Benson Varghese, that he had a trial that was going to go to trial in December. First of all, as a trial lawyer, particularly as a defense attorney, you don't ever want to try cases in December. Jurors are much more benevolent. They're much more prone to punishing in a harsh way, particularly if it's a sad case. And this was the situation in this case. This was, and I told my managing partner, he asked me if I would try the case with him. And I said, of course, which is what you say to the managing partner.
Right.
And I say that he and our good friends, it was a difficult case. We represented a young man who had been charged with two cases of intoxication manslaughter and 5 cases, I believe, of intoxication assault causing serious bodily injury. And it was a young man who was intoxicated at the time and was driving a van with all of these people in the van. And he hit a median on Airport Freeway, and immediately everyone in the van was ejected. And because the force with which he hit the median, the car burst into flames. The individuals were ejected from the car, engulfed in flames. And it was all on video.
Wow.
Because it was, I think it was the TxDOT facilities that records all of the traffic on the highways. And so there was a video, and I think it was from multiple angles, and it was one of the most horrific videos, because you not only saw the people ejected from the car, but you saw them on the side of the road. And I know that at least, I believe, for one of the individuals, you watched life leave them. Mm-hmm. And you watched other people very, 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 and in some cases permanently hurt. So it was a terrible case. Now, when you just hear about that, and the sentiment among the defense bar was, you just need to plead guilty. You need to, and something else that was alleged in the indictment, which is the legal charging instrument, was that the car was a deadly weapon. And the car, anything being a deadly weapon, if a jury finds that that is true, and anything can be a deadly weapon, the definition of that is anything that in the manner of its use or intended use that is capable, not that it does necessarily, but it's capable of causing death or serious bodily injury, can be alleged as a deadly weapon. And so the car was alleged as a deadly weapon. I don't recall, the median may have even been alleged as a deadly weapon. I don't remember now, but... And so the sentiment among our colleagues was that we should plead guilty and throw ourselves on the mercy of the jury, plead true to the deadly weapon, and just beg for forgiveness. And my partner and I analyzed the case and looked at everything, and it was voluminous. The medical records in and of themselves were voluminous. There was also a civil suit brought by the company that owned the van that my client was driving, because he worked as a medical transport, for instance, for individuals who were older, couldn't get to their doctor's appointments, that type of thing, people that were in wheelchairs who couldn't make their doctor's appointments on their own. He would transport them back and forth. And we elected to plead not guilty, and we elected to only try one case. Now, as an attorney, if you only try one case at a time, theoretically, if all of those cases are tried and all result in a verdict, the sentences can all be stacked one on top of each other. So it was really a risky endeavor. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
And so we were trying this case in December, of all things. Now, the other part of the story, which to me, any trial lawyer worth their salt has to tell a story. There has to be a story. And the story in this case was the fact that my client knew all of the people in the van. They were all friends. They all attended college together. They all were survivors of the genocide in Rwanda. They all immigrated or came to the United States for asylum. They all lost family members during the genocide in the mid-90s. And they'd all lost, my client had lost a father and an uncle. They had all lost family members, particularly men, during that brutal, brutal, bloody part of Rwanda's history. So they'd all come to the United States. They were all friends. They were all going to college together. My client was not going full time because he had to work and make money to be able to go to any college. So they were all here on work/student visas. And the rest of the story was that night, my client had worked basically, in essence, or 60 hours that week at his job. And so he was incredibly tired. Well, no one else had a car among his friends except for him. And so they begged him to drive them. he didn't want to because he was so tired and he really just wanted to go to bed. And they said, "You're the only one with a car. You're the only one with transportation. Please, can you just drive us?" And so, being the good friend that he was, he drove them to this graduation party where he did consume alcohol. And he did consume an amount that resulted in his being intoxicated. And really, on his way home, when he was driving them back, he really had fallen asleep. And that's why he hit the median in the middle of the highway. And so when you put all of that, you paint all of this and you give the context to it, you know, they, in many respects, put him behind the wheel of that car, literally and figuratively. And so we tried the case, and the jury was out for a good length of time deciding whether or not he was even guilty.
Wow.
And the police officers had made some unfortunate statements that were recorded and we had found. But they ultimately found him guilty of intoxication manslaughter. But they found that his car, though two people died and five people were seriously injured, was not a deadly weapon. As an attorney, one of the key, what can affect someone's parole if they're sentenced to prison is whether or not a deadly weapon is found. And to our surprise, though we argued against it, I think one of the arguments that we talked about was that this was never what the legislature intended, that he was subjecting himself to that same car and driving. And the jury, pleasantly to our surprise, found the deadly weapon not true. And the reason why that is important is because, as an attorney, if someone is sentenced to a prison sentence and there is no deadly weapon, the parole instruction basically says that you have to serve when the actual time served plus any good conduct time equal a quarter, then you're eligible for parole. Okay. So it's less than a quarter, provided you've been good in prison. Okay. If a deadly weapon is found, then an individual has to serve at least one half flat. There's no credit for good conduct time at all. So it makes a huge difference in terms of the actual time someone must serve before they're eligible to be considered for parole. So right there, that was a huge victory in the jury finding it not true. And then we began the punishment phase. And we put on his sister, who he had hidden during the genocide with. He and his sister had hidden. His sister had been so afraid, and she was very soft-spoken. She had been so afraid during the time that they were in hiding that she had lost the ability to speak. And so her brother protected her and spoke for her. And I'm not talking about just a short period of time. I'm talking about a matter of 2 years. Her brother protected her. And they lived in a place where she had to use an outhouse. And he would get up in the middle of the night if she needed to get up, and he would walk with her. Because there was a huge prevalence of sexual assaults during this genocide. And he wanted to make sure nothing happened to his sister. And that was powerful, powerful testimony to this jury. And then we put his mother on the stand, who, and I don't recall much about what the words she spoke, but she spoke in Swahili, and we had to have a translator. And there was just a point in the mother's testimony when she began just rocking and began begging the jury. And she wasn't speaking in English, but there was no question what she was saying, because there are some things that just transcend all language barriers. And the mother basically just begging for mercy for her son was one of those things. And the fact that the friends really didn't want him prosecuted, they really didn't. They felt like it could have just as easily been one of them behind the wheel. They felt like if they had not asked him to drive that night, he would never have even been in that situation. And he was, our client really was a positive influence in the Rwandan community that had moved and ultimately landed in Texas. So all of that to say, at the end, a case that the state really was hoping for a maximum sentence of 20 years, 11 of the jurors wanted him to get probation. One juror, unfortunately, from the very beginning, the rest of the jurors told us would never consider probation, which is also unfortunate because in jury selection, that's obviously one of the things that we talked to them about.
Right.
And it kind of illustrates the difficulty in getting people to really think about what their views are going to be or are about an offense and really how they feel about the punishment. You know, I have no idea whether she was kind of a sleeper cell and wound up on the jury and knew she could never give probation or even consider probation, or whether or not it was just she really didn't examine and really didn't look introspectively about what her feelings would be about intoxication manslaughter. In the end, we ultimately resolved the case for basically what amounted to credit for time served, or a little bit more than credit for time served, and he was not sent back to Rwanda. That was also one of our big fears, and that is that he would be forced to return to Rwanda, where he had no family and would basically be living on the run and be living in fear of the people that had murdered his family. So he's a productive member of our community and came to see us. We were the first people he came to see when he wrapped everything up. And so that was, to me, one of the biggest examples of what everyone told us was an unwinnable case.
Yeah. And for people who don't understand the genocide in Rwanda, it's heartbreaking. It's complex. I think the best, and it's a piece of art and probably can't come even close to compare the actual atrocities that exist in Rwanda. But Hotel Rwanda does a good job of diving into it. So if you don't understand it, we'll rent that movie, bring a box of Kleenexes because it's a heavy movie.
It
But
is. And I really had only a passing understanding of what happened. And, you know, in order to tell his story, in order to tell the family's story, to understand and explain how he got to where he was, I thought it was necessary for me to kind of educate myself. And it's embarrassing to say I didn't know more about it. But I certainly know now. And it is a part of our world history. It's a tragic part of our world history.
yeah. Well, what would you say would be one of your biggest takeaways from this case, when you're trying these cases that seem like everything's stacked against you?
Well, I think you have to legally analyze it. And even though you feel like the odds are against you, you have to engage as a lawyer and compartmentalize. Okay, we have this legal issue. We have this legal issue. We can attack it from this point, attack it from this point. And sometimes, as an attorney, even though you have all of these challenges and ways in which you can attack the state's case, sometimes you're just it, you have to fight this overwhelming feeling that you're going to lose just because of the sheer gravity of the injuries and of the suffering that happened as a result. And so you have, on the one hand, you have the legal aspects, but on the other hand, you have the very human side of it. And so I guess one of the takeaways, it as hard as it is to try to compartmentalize that and be a lawyer. But the other part of it is to be able to tell a story. You know, it wasn't that we used any magic language. It wasn't that there was anything, you know, Shakespearean about what we did. But the ability to talk to people and the ability to convey our client's story and his family's story, I think really resonated with the jury.
Yeah. And telling that story is, like you said, one of the most paramount things when you're trying a case, more especially in front of a jury trial. Maybe a bench trial, you don't have to focus on that as much. But, you have 12 people who have experienced life in all different ways, and they need to understand this complex system of a law. And the best way to do that is to kind of lay it out in the ways that make it most digestible and easy for us to get it, tell that story and put some humanity on the victims, put it on the defendant, put it on, them as individuals of the state that are making this judgment.
Well, and I think as a defense attorney, one of the things that I've kind of come to realize is that it's really easy as a prosecutor to lump a category of crimes together and say, we need to send a message to the community about this kind of crime. Okay. So as a defense attorney, I think it's incumbent upon us to show why this client and this case is not like everyone else. And that's why it's so important to be able to tell their story.
Right. Well, Christy, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
I love talking to attorneys and getting their war stories, so to say. So I want to thank you for appearing on the podcast with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for indulging my son who's singing in the background.
No worries. This has been Austin Gardner with the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association President's Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to our series on Things I Wish I Knew as a Young Attorney. We hope you subscribe to our podcast and join us for future episodes. I want to thank our guest, Christy Jack, for joining us today. For more information on what is happening with our organization, please check out our website at www.tcyla.org and follow our Instagram account at Tarrant Young Lawyers. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on a brand new episode of the TCYLA Presence Podcast. Have a great day and make good decisions.